Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 663, April 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. This is an episode of our book club. And the book club has begun the march, the exciting march through award shortlists. Nebula Award nominees are on display now. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about two more Nebula nominees. The Hugo nominees are coming out soon, so we'll know how many more books we have to read after this. Only one Nebula nominee remains, but there will be more added to our list for sure. Almost for sure. But in this episode, we read two of them, and so we're going to talk about them and then also tell you what we're reading that we liked. Let me introduce my panelists who are on this book club journey with me. Erica Ensign is here. Hello.
Hi, Jason. I read books.
All right, good. Two books assigned this time. Two books. Yep. A little extra assignment there. Assigned by the Nebula people, not assigned by me. So it's not me. Don't
one of them was short, or at least it felt short.
One of them was very short. Aline Sims is also here. Hi, Aline.
Hi, I also read books.
Nice. Nice. That is, if you didn't, this would be a problem for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a serious problem. Scott McNulty is here from Philadelphia. Hello, Scott.
Hello from Philadelphia, the land of Benjamin Franklin and Wawa.
And Wawa, yes.
What more do you need?
Now, I mentioned Philadelphia because also from Philadelphia, Deb Stanish is here. Hello.
Hey, well, actually the suburbs, but I'm here for the Wawa. I'm closer to the Valley Forge than the Liberty Bell.
All right.
But, you know, we're covering all aspects of historical area. Yes.
Valley Forge is lovely as well. So
it is beautiful.
If you're in the Philadelphia area, visit Valley Forge.
Mm. Well, my grandmother lived for many years in the greater Philadelphia area, too. Does Bucks County even count as greater Philadelphia?
Ooh, not anymore.
Know. It's Pennsylvania. Anyway,
yes.
That part
it's
of
the Midwest,
Pennsylvania
right?
is the greater Philadelphia area.
Well, eastern Pennsylvania. Western Pennsylvania is, as we all know, as we established, and Tony Sindelar will back me up on this, the Midwest. Anyway, people are so angry. We read Spear by Nicola Griffith, the aforementioned short book, and The Mountain in the Sea by Ray Naylor, which in our last episode, I want to say, Scott said was the best octopus-themed book he had read this year. Because there were two, but that was one of them. And let's start with Spear. Nicola Griffith, don't think I've read any of her stuff. This is a short book, 184 pages in hardcover. It is Arthurian mythology with a twist. And so I wanted to state up front, and I'm curious about the panel, I personally know almost nothing about Arthurian mythology. So I came into this and I was like, they probably mean King Arthur. That was about, and then later it was like, oh, is it the Lady of the Lake? I think it is. But like literally knew nothing more than that there was a lady with a lake. So are any of you stronger with Arthurian things? I mean, you are all stronger with Arthurian things than me, because mm-hmm. I am not.
Clearly.
I think I might be about on par with you.
Okay. Mm. You know, you recognize Lancelot and Guinevere. I mean, that was,
and
I was
Merlin.
Like, I could do that. I got it.
Yep.
I got it.
Yep, got Merlin. Yep.
Yep, Merlin, that's, right?
That mm-hmm. was the yep. extent of it for me, really. Yeah. It's not my forte.
I would have said that I don't really know all that much about Arthurian legend. And yet, I read this book and I picked up a lot of stuff. And I read the author's note, which is kind of long and has a lot of like in-depth stuff about the two different types of mythology that she was twisting together, the Arthuriana and the Irish mythology. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's that part. And then, oh, yeah, that guy, I almost forgot about him. Mm. And like, I was like, yeah, so I feel like I might be a little stronger on it than I was giving myself credit for. I have forgotten probably most of it. Like, we read Mort d'Arthur in when I was in high school, I think. So like, I have a foundation in it, but that was a long time ago.
Erica, my foundation in it is Monty Python's Holy Grail, yeah, and Spamalot on Broadway. Uh-huh. That is the extent of my knowledge.
I think a lot of mine came from other fictional works that were riffing on it, like the Finnevar Tapestry and some of the other like series that used it at the core, Marion Zimmer Bradley stuff. But yeah, so I picked up on, I guess, quite a bit.
Yeah, I kind of the same way. There was a time when I was like really deep into Arthurian stuff. We read, again, La Mort d'Arthur. We read Geoffrey of Monmouth, a lot of that sort of stuff around it. And of course, Percival like picked up on that right away because of the Fisher King and the Holy Grail and all of that. But it was... I think I've forgotten more than I thought I did because I was going through. I'm like, this is kind of like twinging a bell, but I didn't pick up on it immediately. I kind of had to go back and reread it. I'm like, oh, I see what she did there. That's clever.
I've checked, by the way, my entire knowledge of Arthurian mythology is totally from The Sword in the Stone.
Disney movie. I mean, that's, you know, that's solid. Something.
That's solid. It. Scott, do you have any Arthurian knowledge that you're bringing to bear here?
I have a degree in English. And so many years ago when I was in college, I read some things about Arthurian legend. And we all know, since I only vaguely remember what happens in Spear, you can imagine how much I remember of what I've read in college,
right?
Which is to say very little.
Mm-hmm. All right. But hey, you got that degree. They can't take that away from you. I mean, probably you'd have to do something really bad for them to take that away from you.
Yes.
So
very, very bad.
Yeah. And even then, they probably still wouldn't. No. So I don't know if they revoke degrees at all. Anyway, weird. Don't do anything bad, Scott. Anyway, Spear.
I make no promises.
So what I thought was interesting about Spear. So Spear is about it's interesting. It's about a girl who is raised by a kind of weird witch lady, and they hide in a cave, and they don't know about the world, but the girl wants to explore and ends up going on a journey to the wider world and deciding that she wants to become a knight. And so she hides that she's a girl and gets some armor and stuff from a dead guy she finds. And then it turns out has some supernatural powers that allow her to defeat various villains and defend lands, and ultimately ends up being invited to Camelot, essentially. Although the names are not quite the same because they're using, I assume these are other, they're, you know, from roots from actual
Welsh.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot of Welsh. There's a lot of consonants. Anyway, and so it is on one level an Arthurian adventure story, but with a bunch of interesting twists involving the fact that the main character is a woman playing a role that is generally is a man in the mythos, and so you get all sorts of different kind of things going on. The Lady of the Lake also appears and reveals a lot about her, our main character's background, and who the witch is, and who Merlin really is, and the status of Merlin, and their brother and sister, and so they're intertwined, and there's a lot going on here, but it is also fundamentally a coming of age story about this main character, I also thought it was interesting too that it's definitely got LGBT themes and relationships. But one of the things that I thought was interesting is that our main character is referred to by other people as he because she's pretending to be a man so she can be a knight, but is always gendered by the narrator as a she. So this is one of those cases of a woman who has to pretend to be a man. So I would say not a trans theme, but there are definitely gay themes in it, as well as lots of gender critique kind of things going on. Also, I was reminded of, what is it, Brienne from Game of Thrones, where it's like, she's stronger than the guys anyway, so maybe you should let her be a knight. And there's some of that going on here. Plus, she has like her spider sense where she can defeat that red knight because she's got the ability to like see where he's going to go. And that's that for me, that was the moment of like, yeah, she can basically defeat anybody because she has magic powers. Anyway, it's her kind of adventure figuring out who she is and reaching Camelot. And it's less than 200 pages. So that's kind of what it is. She goes to the lake and learns the story of her mother and her origin and kind of resolves it. So that's what Spear is. I enjoyed it, feeling like I was missing half of the references, but getting that it's a coming of age story with some interesting kind of magic and twists from even the things that I know about Arthurian mythology. So that was sort of what I took away from it I really actually enjoyed her adventure stuff. And when it gets to Camelot, I'm like, okay, I get it. It's got to come due now. We really need to resolve all of the mythology here. But honestly, I kind of liked it when she's like an itinerant knight, cleaning up people's messes and in love with the stable girl.
The comely maidens.
That was kind of great.
But, I think the thing I really liked about the story, because, I mean, basically it is a retelling of Arthur, and there's only so many twists and turns you can take with that, because the structure of the story is the same. And this really does sort of lean really heavily on, and I know I'm going to mangle the name of this, but it was a French poet around 1160, I think it was, looking at the Wikipedia page. It was Chrétien de Troyes, who wrote the Percival and the Fisher King legend. And it was like sort of like the thing that raised Percival out of the obscurity of the Round Table. And the story follows pretty closely along those lines. But what I thought was interesting, it wasn't that she just didn't want to become a knight, that she wanted to feel like she belonged to something bigger. She wanted to find a place. It wasn't the glory of the battle and it wasn't the fight. I mean, obviously she was exhilarated in her own strength, but her motivation was like finding a home, was finding a place where she belonged. And I thought that was an interesting twist on all of the glory hounding that you read about in so many of the Arthurian legends.
Yeah. And so it's Percival the Welsh name, which is Peredur, is who this character is, but it is the Percival analog going on here.
Mm-hmm. I also liked, I mean, it's the Arthurian legend, but it's also intertwined with some like Welsh and Irish fairy mythology, which are not necessarily mythologies that are, I mean, probably somebody else has pulled them together before, but it wasn't something that I had seen before. So you have the Tuatha De Danann and all that kind of stuff mixed in. And there's this whole side where there are fairies and they exist outside of the world. Fairies are not human, but they can have babies with humans. Mm-hmm. I wonder what would happen there. And it takes the sort of like the four important magic items that the fairies have and basically makes them some of the Arthurian things, like the Grail.
The Grail and Excalibur. The sword. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And the spear.
Right.
Yeah, that was an interesting twist.
The titular spear. That. Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I really enjoyed the, like, Deb's right, like the Arthurian structure myth is kind of set in stone, just like a sword, haha. And there are a lot of twists that have already sort of been done with it. So I appreciated the sort of weaving in of a different mythology and layering the two on top of each other. And yes, like everybody in the book has like two names, because you get the, you know, the one name that you might recognize and then the Welsh version or the Irish version and descriptions of them. And, you know, there were times where I thought that there was almost a little much of that, where it was just like, okay, I don't need quite the entire backstory history of every single character if they're only going to be on the page for, you know, a sword fight. But I still, I appreciated that she had gone to the work to put all that together. Even though it was only 184 pages, it did a occasionally feel like it got bogged down in some of that, especially at the beginning. I had a little bit of trouble even figuring out where we were in the world. I did not know it was an Arthurian mythology story to start with. And it was it took me some time to sort of find my footing and figure out what what was happening, and B, to come to any kind of resonance with the main character. I really kind of bounced off her at first because I just didn't know where to deal was. I felt like the writing itself, the prose was, I don't know, it reminded me a little too much, I think, sometimes of the Arthur, like the older Arthurian mythos stuff. It was a little bit, I don't know, stodgy is not the right word. That is not the word that I want, but something that's in between stodgy and fluid and relaxed. Something in the middle there is sort of where this landed, and it did make it a little bit hard for me to read sometimes, getting through it.
I had a really hard time getting into it. I defaulted to my... I bought it as an audiobook first, and was listening to it, and my eyes kept glazing over, and I'd be like 5 minutes into it and I had no idea what was happening. And so I'd restart it and the same thing happened. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll read it. So I bought an ebook version and the same thing happened. And I finally had to sit down and read it with my eyeballs while listening to it to be able to get into it, because there was just something about the way the first chapter especially, or the first part, was written that I could not pay attention to. It was like a Charlie Brown teacher talking to me. once I finally got, you know, several chapters into it, I was fine, and I ended up listening to the rest of it because I knew I would not read like the names and the place names correctly. So I wanted to have a more correct pronunciation in my ears for all of the places, even though I wouldn't be able to say them now. But I really struggled to get into it. And I don't know that I ever completely overcame that. I felt a little distant. I don't know how to describe it other than I felt a little distanced from the book as I was listening to it. I didn't feel immersed in it. I think maybe part of that was because I knew, like Jason, I knew that there were references and I knew there was stuff that I just was not getting. And so I think that maybe I was a little in my own head about it too, as I was trying to frantically consume the rest of this book today before we recorded.
But you know what, Aline, I don't think it's just that, at least, because I picked up on a lot of the references. And I think the way that you just described it is a really good way to put sort of my experience, like feeling a little bit removed from it. Some stories I read and I just feel like I'm immersed and I'm flowing with the character, and I never really got that feeling. I think I was more intellectually interested in what she was doing with the Arthurian mythos. So I don't think I was necessarily any more immersed in it than you were, but I think I was maybe more interested in it simply because I kind of saw the structures and knew what she was playing with.
Scott, what do you think?
So this may be indicative of my enjoyment of the book, but after I finished it, I thought to myself, is that a novel? So then I looked up the Nebula novel rules and how long this book was. And in fact, it is technically a novel for the Nebulas. And for
it's
the
real close.
yes, it's very short. But that's not to say I don't think it's a bad book. I think it's well written. I think it is about a thing that I care very little about, and so I had a hard time connecting with it. Arthurian legend doesn't really do much for me, so I would have never read this book if it weren't nominated. Mm-hmm. But that does, I think it was good and well written. I don't have much to say about it because I didn't really connect with it.
I'm with you. It's not my cup of tea, but I connected with it, like I said, in the sense that I really liked the coming of age part of it and her kind of like, she finds her place. And then we also discover that she's sort of got some special powers, and that part of it was fun. The Camelot stuff, what I liked about it is that Arthur has basically been told, or Artos, that she's going to be his downfall, essentially. He doesn't trust her like everybody else does, which is, I think it's an interesting dynamic. I enjoyed the idea that Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere are a romantic triple, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was nice.
I thought that was kind of fun, and like, that's like, we were all thinking it. So let's just make that canon. I thought that was fun. The twist with sort of, that her mother is Merlin's sister and that her parent is a fairy, and that the four items, I mean, I like the spinning on like the Holy Grail and Excalibur and the spear. These are all magic items that are part of this. And she ends up sort of with her revenge on her father who abandoned her. But I agree with Scott that I would never have chosen to read this other than the fact that it was on a short list. But I did like it. I think it is very well done. I said to Aline before we started that I didn't notice. I swear I didn't notice the commas. I know that it was really a problem for Aline. I didn't notice it.
Was.
I did think it was a little bit of a slow starter, but then because when it's really like a person who's never seen the world, who's in a cave with her kind of weird mother, I'm like, what is this? Like, what am I even reading here? But then I did get into it more after that. And I think it's very well done. And the backstory is that there's an anthology called Sword Stone Table. Anyway, that is a remixed Arthurian anthology. And this was originally going to be in that. And then it got too long for that. So it is ironically just long enough to be called a novel, but also got too long to be in that short story anthology. But it's the same idea here. And I think it's fun once I realized what I was seeing. And yet, you know, it's also true that this is not my particular cup of tea, and I can't get excited by the, I appreciate that she's remixing Arthurian mythology here. I really do. But I feel like it's a lot of the cleverness is lost on me because I just don't know any of it or care that much about it. But I did enjoy it as a coming of age story. Yeah.
You know, I think if you're somebody who does enjoy Arthurian myth and are, you know, this is your jam, it really is kind of a fun puzzle to read because I found myself, because I knew going into it, it was a retelling of this story. So I kind of knew what I was getting into. I knew what to expect. I was a little confused at the beginning, like, how are we doing this? Where are we taking this? But after that, it was like a little, you know, sort of a thought puzzle and a little game that I was playing with myself. Like, okay, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing here? How is this going to tie in? To the point where I did go back and reread some passages and some sections once I realized what the story was doing. But that is not everybody's jam, and that's okay. But if you do think that this is something, you know, you're interested in because of the subject matter, I think it is a really fun little quirky addition to the mythos.
Yeah, I agree. If you are into Arthuriana, absolutely check it out. The other thing that I really liked about it is the end. And I mean, I don't want to get super duper spoilery, but it left me feeling good. And I was really worried because not every Arthuriana type tale leaves you feeling happy. Some of them leave you feeling sad. Some of them leave you feeling downright icky. It seems kind of like one of the rarest things is how warm and nice I sort of felt about the characters at the end. And yeah, and Jason, you mentioning that, you know, Lancelot and Arthur and Guinevere are a like happy and successful polyamorous relationship, which is another thing that you don't see like reflected all that often. I mean, quite often in the Arthurian tales, it's more of a love triangle or something like that. And I tend to prefer the ones where it's not, where yes, they are just all one big happy family. And that's totally what they did here. And I like that.
I think it's a fun read for anybody except to leave.
it was fine once I could read it.
Yeah, but if you're into anything Arthurian or even like you're just into kind of a knights with magic, like this is your jam, right? This is going to be for you. You're going to kind of enjoy it. And then yes, it has the LGBT themes as well on a few levels, that because mm-hmm. in addition to pretending to be a man in order to be a knight, our main character also, like I mentioned, meets the stable girl and has a relationship with her that she has to leave. It was sweet. It was really sweet. Mm-hmm. So, and then she runs into her later and she's married and it's like, you know, never going to measure. It was really one of those things like, you know, he's never going to measure up to me. It was one of those things. It was, I enjoyed that.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Let's move on to Mountain in the Sea by Ray Naylor. Which is a book about
longer.
An octopus, and it's longer. It's 464 pages. It is longer. So the way that this was described to me, probably by Scott, is what if we discovered an intelligent species and it had a first contact situation, but it was on Earth in the ocean? There's a super intelligent sentient human level intelligence octopus species that is discovered. So I went in thinking that was going to be the book, and that is in there, but that is one plot of the book, is that mm-hmm. there is this place in Vietnam, these islands that have been a sanctuary that have been bought out by a corporation or corporation foundation thing. But the truth is that there is a monster that's been killing people there, and it's actually an intelligent octopus species. It's also a story about a guy who is kidnapped and put on an AI-operated fishing boat where they're basically slaves who have to work as fishermen on a boat that they never see land, and they're guarded and by guards who are human, but the AI runs the boat. And I'll just, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but like, what happens if you kill the guards? Nothing. Because the AI still runs the boat. So that's going on. So there's artificial intelligence there. And then it's also the story of a hacker, an AI hacker, who has gotten really good at looking at, I don't know, mind maps and figuring out ways to navigate artificial intelligences in order to, you know, to hack them and get them to do what you want, or, you know, whatever you might need. This guy is like the expert in that. So it's these three interlinked stories.
Well, and there's also another story about the android who may or may not be sentient itself.
Right. Oh, I should say, yes. So our one of our main characters comes to the islands where the octopus are, and on that island is the world's one and only sentient android, because after they made him, everybody was like, okay, that's illegal.
And let's never do that again.
And the company bought the island and was like, well, I guess we'll just put him on our island because he can't go anywhere else. So there's lots of themes of what is intelligence and art, and what is sentience, and what does it mean to be sentient, and can you even measure it, in running through in all of these different storylines. And I didn't really expect that from the book. And I know that not everybody is going to share this opinion, but I'm going to go with Scott, who recommended this last time, and say, I loved this book. And the moment that I knew I loved it is one of those segments with the AI hacker guy, because it's got a real powerful William Gibson kind of vibe to it. The idea that this guy is kind of, you know, shady, and there are shady people dealing with him, and he gets his sort of girlfriend killed at one point by telling her too much, and they're listening with their, you know, drone mosquito spy bots. And so that's going on separately from the other really interesting aspects of it. The incredibly depressing thing about the people on the boat, and what's happening with the android and our scientist at the island trying to figure out the octopus. So there's a lot going on here. I thought it was really great. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, and it was one of those books that as I was reading, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, this is going to be one of those. This is going to be one of those that I tell people about. So I thought it was very cool and fun. And so thank you, Scott. I mean, we were read it anyway, but I thank you for recommending it. And you almost undersold it to me, honestly.
Well, you know, that's my specialty. You know, undersell things that you like to people because they may not like it, and then you won't be disappointed if they don't like it.
Under-promise and over-deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I obviously agree with you, Jason, but I'm very curious about what our three compatriots here.
Me too. Compatriots?
I'm afraid. I'm afraid to say anything.
I'll start. The fifth. I was so excited by this book because sometimes you read like a first line. I'm always excited by the first lines of books and stories. Like, what does the author choose to put down as the first thing you're going to see? And I was thrilled when I read the first line of this book. Night, District 3 of the Ho Chi Minh Autonomous Trade Zone. And I was like, yes, this book is for me. This sounds amazing. I am in. That was my favorite part of the book.
It's a good opener.
Yeah.
It's
like a robo helicopter. Like this, yeah, sure.
This was a book that was, I mean, it's well written. It's just super not for me. It's very philosophical and it's about the ocean. And as we have determined in previous episodes of the Incomparable Book Club, I don't really care for books about the ocean. And there's a lot of ocean in this book.
There is.
I don't know if it's because oceany stuff tends to get more contemplative and philosophical, but I just felt like this book was sort of crawling up its own backside in terms of what is the nature of you know, humanity and you know, feelings, and like every single bit and piece that you were talking about, Jason, all of those things, like if you had described them to me and I had not read them myself, I would be like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, there's an android and even they don't even know if they are truly human. That's fascinating. I probably wouldn't have cared about the octopus stuff, but like all the rest of it, the AI boat and like just described to me as concepts sounds great. And somehow the journey of the 464 pages of going through it, and you know, it was beautiful prose. There were sentences that were just like, I can see that is poetic and lovely. It just didn't work for me on an emotional level at all. I think this is one that if it wasn't for an award and if I wasn't going to talk about it on a podcast, I probably would have stopped at some point. I kept going hoping that maybe at the end something would happen that would turn me around on it. And it was kind of the opposite. It was just like by the end, I was really, really ready to be done. So, I mean, I still gave it 3 stars because I recognize the work that went into it and that it's, you know, it's kind of beautiful, but it's sort of like a painting in, you know, you go to an art gallery and you're walking along and some paintings are going to like stand out to you and you're going to stare at them for a little while, but I'm just going to walk past this one because it just doesn't, it's like, yep, I can see somebody went through a lot of work to paint that and I'm going to go to this corner where there's some sculpture or something. Also, there was one line that I actually found really offensive toward the end of the book talking about the nature of consciousness and I think building AI and stuff. There was a line where it says, but in the end you aren't anything but a prosthesis, you can't replace real support. I think that was talking about one of the like AI friends that are programmed to sort of like be your partner but not a real person.
Oh, right. Yes.
That was, again, a really cool idea, but the idea that you aren't anything but a prosthesis, you can't replace real support, I just felt like, wow, the person who wrote this maybe doesn't have a lot of experience with disabled people who use prostheses, because you know that is real support.
Real support,
that
actually, like literally,
yeah,
real.
It literally works. So by that point I was kind of already turned off, but that was one that I had to highlight because I was angry. So
that's their
where
one.
I
what is it? What are they? 1.5s.
0.5s.
Oh,
just
0.5s. They're not a plus one. They're a 0.5. And the idea there is that they're, and we're introduced to one before we know what it is. And then we're introduced to the concept. And so you get to have that moment where you're like, oh, she's talking to her boyfriend back home, but he's not real.
And the thing is, I knew that the whole time. Like it didn't surprise me It was just too weird. Their interactions were just too weird, and I was like, "Oh, this is not a this is not real."
I'm impressed. It got me.
I also struggled with this book, and I, Jason, you said the page count, and I was like, "Oh, is that all?" Like, it just. I started listening to this as in the car as we were driving on an extremely long journey. And my husband made me stop it because it was too boring and it was putting him to sleep while he was driving. And it made me think about, I often talk about, people ask, you know, what's your favorite book? And I'm like, well, I feel obligated to say Jane Eyre is my favorite book. And at one point, a friend of mine tried to read Jane Eyre and she was like, the description of the moors, and it just went on and on and on about the moors and how gray they were and how, like, looking and gazing contemplatively over the moors. And she's like, I just can't stand it. I couldn't read it. And I felt like that as they were just, as the author was describing a building, an old hotel, in the brutalist style and the concrete and the blah. And I was just like, oh, it's going to be one of those books. And it was one of those books. It just was not what I needed at this point in time in my life. Like Erica, I can recognize that there was a lot of beauty in the writing, and I just felt like the book was talking at me rather than trying to get me invested in it. Like, it just, I don't know. It was like being in a college lecture hall with 500 other students. I just couldn't get into it.
Especially the bits, there were little excerpts from books that were written by a couple of the characters at the beginning of each chapter. And at the beginning, I was like, okay, I can see how these are fitting in. And by the end, I was sort of skimming them and I was getting annoyed.
No, I didn't like those either. And I gave it 5 stars and I didn't like those either. It was too much. It's too much. That was where it did get up its own backside for sure. Deb, what do you think?
I'm kind of with you, Jason. I really, really like this book. It's like the Spear was nice. It was good. It was a great read. I really enjoyed that. But when I was finished Spear, I put Spear down. I did not think about Spear again. This book stuck with me a lot because there's so many, you think you're reading one thing, but there's really so many levels of complexity in this story. You know, there's themes of loneliness. I mean, our two scientists are incredibly lonely and people themselves are just lonely, which is why you get these 0.5s running all over the place and they're all little Oculuses. You know, the technology distancing people and what it means to be human. And there's so much to chew on in this story. And even the black and white or in the gray areas of morality, because you have a little bit of both of that, where you have Dyneema talking about, you know, we own so many different things and I can't be bothered with the main scientist, who I'm not even going to try to pronounce her name because I know I'll mangle it horribly. When she talks about Dyneema being taken over bit by bit, and she's like, I don't understand all the financials. That's not my job. It was just there for the science. And it turns out that Dyneema was the owner of the AI slave ships. It was run by Dyneema, which, you know, I did not see that twist coming. I did see the fake boyfriend being being a 0.5. But there's also the morality of the Stork Society, in that they're so dead set on what it means to be human and taking out Evrim, that they don't care about the collateral damage, which is just really feels so much like a play on what's happening with the pro-life movement right now. It doesn't matter what the collateral damage is, as long as the pure tenet of philosophy is that, you know, we this is what we believe in and this is what we're going to do. So I think there was so much to chew on in this book that it just really, it really kept my attention, even though there's so many horrible things that happen and there's so it's not a good look on humanity in general.
No.
It really makes you think that maybe we should just let the AIs have everything because humanity is pretty crappy. Yeah, it's all pretty crappy.
Leave it to the octopuses, exactly.
But there was one, you know, you talk about the little, and I agree, the little beginning of the chapter notes from their books and the lectures of the scientists that, that did start to get wearing. But there, and Erica, I had to laugh when you say, I just don't like books about the sea. Because there was one quote by Ha in her book about the oceans where she said, you know, we came from the ocean and we only survive by carrying salt water with us all our lives in our blood and in our cells. The sea is our true home. This is why we find the shore so calming. We stand where the waves break like exiles returning home. And as somebody who has never lived more than like 75 miles from the ocean, like I felt that so deeply.
Yeah. You know? I'm a landlocked baby.
No, man. Like, you know, like there's times when you like physically, I need to be by the ocean. Yep. I need to be by that water. Sure. And like that thing hit, that quote just hit so hard. And there's a couple really good passages like that. It is beautifully written. But it's a book that like I finished it yesterday, early evening, and I was laying in bed last night thinking about this story. And I, you know, when a book does that to you, it makes you question what you've read. Question just the idea of humanity and people and technology, and are we doing the right things and the inverse reactions of technology? Like this is a keeper for me. I really, really liked it.
I feel like life makes me ask those questions too much already. I didn't need a book to tell me.
And I watched The Next Generation a lot growing up. I've seen The Measure of a Man many, many, many times. So like that's very foundational to my consciousness is thinking about like the nature of humanity and what makes people human and what qualifies as sentience and all of that. So it wasn't even thought provoking for me on that level.
Yeah, I kind of find that part to be the least interesting. Like, does this AI have a right to live? Like that to me was the least interesting part of the book. It just felt like it was there as a prop to have all these other discussions.
Well, and I kind of thought it was doing the opposite of Measure of a Man, though. Instead of questioning whether the android is conscious and sentient, it's questioning the very idea of sentience and how you know, right? Because the creator turns to the android and says, oh, you're not sentient. And it kind of like ruins his entire life. And then she's like, because nobody's sentient. We're all just, you know, doing whatever it is, right? And
well, automatons.
So I thought, yeah. So I thought that was an interesting inversion. I mean, it's not original to this book, but I think it's coming at it from a very different and perhaps deeper philosophical bent than Measure of Man, which is a wonderful episode of TNG. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to say it's exactly like that. I'm just saying it's something that it's an episode of a show that I watched from a very young age that has had me thinking about this for a long, long, long time.
Yeah, I think having the android who doesn't know if they're actually sentient or not and questioning the whole nature of it while they're interacting with these octopuses, which we haven't even talked about, like, but the idea that these octopuses have had this incredible pressure placed on them that has allowed them to do the things that would be required for an octopus. They have longer lives and they become more social, and they turns out they've been there for a while and nobody really understood it for a while. And there's the one character who saw somebody else get killed by the octopus, who is literally like walking down the beach,
and then
kills him. And then he was accused of the crime, but he didn't do it. And of course he's interviewed by people who then drug him and kill him, because those people are very bad, and they're trying to hack in and do all those things. There's this kind of noirish thing with the hacker and with the mysterious people who are interviewing everybody who's involved. I also thought, you know, I mean, the crumbling hotel that they're doing all of this in, and it turns out that the octopuses have been watching them from the hotel pool, and that, you know, again, it's sort of like you think you're initiating first contact, but the contact has been going on for quite a while and you haven't been aware of it because they're smart. You're not, you don't have the upper hand in this relationship. I thought it was interesting, and I really liked that it was in this crumbling hotel. It has a very claustrophobic, the world is falling apart kind of feeling that I liked. It's I got similar vibes to The Wind Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi. Similar kind of this is, you know, East Asia, Southeast Asia, and 21st century, and, you know, things are kind of like falling apart, and new power structures, corporate power structures are involved. And I thought that was all kind of fun. But yes, Dyanema, the you know, whenever you've got a big acronymed organization, like probably bad, right? What is another funny quirk is that there are like AI monks on the island, and the AI monks have memories of people but are not considered sentient. They're sort of just AI. They're like robots that also can look at a database of somebody's memories. But it turns out that, of course, that the monks are the ones who are maneuvering against Dyonima and take over the island from them at the end. And our one character, our one tangential character from the robot fishing ships, just sort of like ends up on the shore at the end. I mean, it is it's thematically linked, and then it sort of like comes together at the end. And it's sort of like, okay, all right, I guess. But and they were kidnapped from that island too. So
yeah. Now that I'm thinking about it, the two parts that I like the most, the two storylines that I enjoyed the most were, Rustem, who was the hacker that we have mentioned, and Aiko, who was the guy that was kidnapped and forced to work as a slave on the fishing ship. I'm still not entirely sure why those are the ones that spoke to me the most, but I think I appreciated that those were the two characters that were actively like working towards something. They seemed to have, in a way, I don't know, they seemed sure of themselves. And, even when they were questioning things, they had a specific goal that they were working towards, where some of the other storylines, like Ha, the scientist, and then later when we discovered like the woman who created Evrim, like they're just messes. Like both of them have sort of, gone crazy. One has tried to commit suicide a bunch of times. The other one has pulled back into herself so much that the only person that she ever talks to is just her 0.5, who I did not notice right away that it was a 0.5, but as soon as it was revealed, I was like, totally 100% makes sense. And I think that I bounced off their helplessness isn't the right word, but just they were flailing so much in terms of emotional setups that I found it a little bit off-putting. Even though the sciencey stuff was interesting, I think I was more interested in the characters who were trapped in a sort of more physical way, but were working through things in their head in a more, I don't know, positive way, I guess, making strides forward. Like even Aiko, who is trapped on the ship and he's got this weird memory palace where he stores all of his memories, like he's becoming a better person because he's recognizing that caring for other people is a good thing. And like that was kind of nice, but it also left me really depressed, being like, wow, it takes an awful lot for somebody to learn to care for other people. That's sad.
I enjoyed that Ha and our android, and then ultimately the woman who's sort of set up Dyonima are so broken, because I enjoy that the idea that these are broken people, but they're also maybe not even people. They're also the exact right people to figure out this mystery. And I enjoyed that they do have a mission. The mission is to go down or send little robot subs or themselves down into where the octopuses live and try to figure out how to communicate with them. And I would say that part of it reminded me of Arrival a little bit. I mean, that's an obvious one, but it was a little bit of that. There's no, weird time stuff. It's just, how do you talk to the octopus aliens? And these are aliens that live on Earth. I thought that was interesting that they're really messed up and broken, but they're also like the ones who are the right people to solve this and to prove this momentous thing. And I that part obviously worked for me and didn't work for you, but that's what I took away from it.
And the motives, I agree. I think Aiko was a great character because he touches on something that is so critical to this whole point of this whole novel, is the importance of making those connections, which seem to be lost in the world that we're in. People are they seem to be, even though there's more technology, they're very isolated, which is why the existence of these 0.5s is almost really horrifying. And talking about, Ha makes a really, really close connection and shares confidences with Evrim. And I think that's the point of the real, which really matters in that relationship between the AI and humans, because he can be whatever he is programmed to be. And they realize that the motivation of what's happening with Dyneema is not because, oh, we want to find this amazing thing. It's how can we find this amazing thing so we can build better brains?
We can exploit
this thing, right? And again, we get back to, at the end, these Tibetan monk robots are probably the most, I don't know, upstanding creatures in the whole novel. Like, you really root for them. I was so excited when they took over the island and we found out that the security guard was actually the nun, who was the, you know, third best hacker or the second best hacker in the world. So, I mean, all those little touches that were subtle, just really, like I said, this is one you really think about after, and it stays with you, and it makes you question, what am I reading a novel from this perspective? Am I reading it from a different perspective? Like, what is the message that's trying to be sent? Or is it all just this big glorious mess of humanity, which is basically humanity is just a big mess. And we've really screwed things up. And where do we go from that?
It's a really good book that I just didn't like that much.
Well, our hacker also, and he's got the thing where, like, there's the guy who's like, we could get you out. And he makes a good decision at the end, right? He basically is like, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to walk away.
Well, that was one of the bits that I thought, because there's a couple of different scenes where, like, I was completely fooled at the end. There's the scene where you have this nice cop who is, you know, I'm just here to listen. Here's my card if you ever want to do the right thing. And then you come to the scene on a boat where you have the nice old cop and a hacker sitting across the table. And I totally thought that hacker across the table was Rustem, was our hacker from earlier in the book. And I thought so until the end of that scene. I was like, wow, I liked that guy. Why did they just kill him off like that? That was really weird and anticlimactic, only to later discover it was a different hacker who had been hired. And so, like, there were clever moments in the book where I was just like, wow, that was very skillfully done. Nice. Hat tip to the audience.
And I am still not sure, because we have that moment where the hacker goes into, Rustem goes in and talks to the old man who said, you know, if you ever want to get out, like, come see me, who told the story about the dogs. And he's been injured when that freighter crashed into the land. I'm still not sure if the point of that, of the freighter, was to kill the hacker.
Oh, yeah.
Or was to take out, like,
or the policeman.
Right. Like, who is the most arrogant individual here that thinks they're the center of the story? That this, you know what I mean? But that's a really good question, because everybody, as we talked about in our last book club, you know, everybody thinks they're at the center of the end, the arrogance of, I am in a point of history that is so important, and it's really not. And here you have two individuals like, oh my gosh, they sent a whole ass freighter out to kill me, and they both think it was designed for them. And I think I still don't know which way I lean on that, which just fascinates me.
Why not both?
It could be both. That would be really,
as always with our discussions, I hope that it has resolved whether you should read this book or not based on do you feel like Alina and Erica, or do you feel like me and Scott and Deb? Because that is where you're going to have to make your decision. Yeah, having the hacker.
Did you grow up near the ocean? Or did you grow up far away from the ocean?
Having the hacker, the hacker stuff was so neuromancer-esque too, that really just did it for me. I love that kind of stuff. So all the stuff with the hacker, you know, because it really is three very different kinds of genres almost of story, where you've got this, I'd say almost like a sci-fi Jack London-esque tale of survival on the ship. And then you've got a William Gibson-esque noirish hacker, you know, on the run, powerful figures trying to get him to do stuff for them, that part. And then you've got the weird undersea mystery that's happening on the island. And so it is three very different feeling stories that are happening simultaneously. Yeah, it just blew me away. So The Mountain and the Sea, Ray Naylor, blew enough people away for it to be nominated for a Nebula Award. So there.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Let's move on to what books we are reading that we would like to recommend to you, a segment we like to do at the end of the book club. And for that, let's start with Erica, who is going to not recommend novels at all, but is going to recommend some short fiction. So we'll allow it.
Yes. I will say that issue 49 of Uncanny Magazine has a short story called Can I Offer You a Nice Egg in This Trying Time by Ayori Kusano. It's not a portal fantasy, but if you like portal fantasies the way that I do, you should read it. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. Also, there in I think it's in issue 50, there's a story called Waystation City by A.T. Greenblatt. It's a mysterious city where people sometimes end up mysteriously and then they wait. And sometimes they have to wait a long time for a ticket back to their own time and place. Some people don't want to wait, so they risk the Undercity. It's just this lovely, mysterious story about change and choices, and I heartily recommend it. And I also then want to sort of cast your mind back to our book club where we talked about Babel, the boarding school from the point of view of a non-white outsider. If you enjoyed that aspect of Babel, but you would like sort of a more gothic storytelling style and you prefer witchcraft to silver-based magic, I super highly recommend a novella called Radcliffe Hall by Miyuki Jane Pinkard. It was also in Uncanny Magazine. It's another British boarding school told from the perspective of an outsider with white supremacy as the big bad. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
All right. Aline, anything?
Yeah, I have been reading a lot of bad romances lately. I'm not saying that all romances are bad. It's just the ones I've been reading are bad. But I do have two really good books that I have read lately. The first has been recommended before. It's The Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman. And it's just basically what if a bunch of retirees solved cold case murder mysteries for fun and then got dragged into a current murder spree. And eventually, not a spoiler, because all mysteries end up with the murder solved the mystery.
Gasp.
It was really a sweet book, I think. The mystery aspect of it didn't pull me in as much as the characters. And I just got the second book from the library, so I'm super excited to start that soon. And then the second book is A Lady for a Duke by Alexis Hall. This is a good romance that I've read lately. And it's a soldier, one of many soldiers, is presumed dead at Waterloo because that's what happens in war. And they take the opportunity to come back as a lady's maid and a woman rather than the Duke she used to be. Hijinks ensue. It's a romance. So there's romance. It's a little long, but it's a really sweet book, I thought. And it's kind of friendship and romance and acceptance and love, and it was very sweet. So I recommend that book too.
All right. Deb, any recommendations for us?
I do. Your nonfiction auntie is here with another I recently read West with the Night, and it's a memoir of Beryl Markham, who was a pilot in the colonial British Africa in the 1920s and 30s. And she actually became the first person who flew the England to North America route solo. Everybody talks about Lindenberg, but she made it from England to North America. She didn't quite make it to New York. She crashed in Canada because she ran out of their engine end up icing up. This book actually was published in the 1940s, I believe, and then quickly went out of print. But in 1982, a California restauranter was reading a collection of Ernest Hemingway's letters, and he came across a passage where Hemingway was just like waxing lyrical about Markham's prose, and to the point he says, "It felt that I was simply a carpenter with words after reading what she had written." So this restauranter convinced somebody to bring this book back into print in 1983, and it became very celebrated. The reason I liked it, okay, caveat, it is written from a white person's perspective in 1920s and 1930s, you know, Africa. There is some definite casual racism and colonialism involved. But there's also very, very deep respect for Africa, a deep respect for the people that live there. There is what's really fascinating is this woman lived an amazing life. She was rumored to be to be romantically involved with the Prince of Wales. A lot of people have read Out of Africa, the Isaac Dinesen novel, and she was part of that whole circle. But in her memoir, she does not talk about any of her romantic relationships at all. Like, there is nothing about this. This is about her growing up in Africa, about her being, she was a horse trainer, her father owned horses. She actually started out as a horse trainer, being one of the first women horse trainer who was successful to do this in this time and place. And it is very much a beautifully, beautifully written memoir about a life lived that doesn't include any romantic entanglements at all, which if you've read a lot of memoirs with women, unfortunately, that tends to play into, because that's their power. Most points in history did not have a lot of personal power. It was all through their romantic entanglement. So for a woman to be as groundbreaking as she was, to accomplish what she did, and to write the most beautiful, beautiful descriptions of country and people, I do recommend it. With those caveats, know what you're getting into.
All right. Thank you. Auntie, nonfiction auntie.
Nonfiction auntie.
Scott, what do you have for us?
I don't have any nonfiction, but I do have a mystery. Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone by Benjamin Stevenson, which is a great title. And you would think, does the novel live up to said title? Well, maybe not, but it is very good. But I will, with a caveat that... So there are trends in mysteries, as there are in many things. And one of the trends is kind of metafictional mysteries. And this is one of those. It's written, the character who is the narrator is an author of books on how to write mysteries and is writing this book based on something that happens in his family's reunion. And there are kind of notes from his agent and all kinds of things. So it is, if that kind of thing annoys you, you will not like this book. But if you are intrigued, maybe you'll like it. It does have some very kind of, like I had to stop reading the book at a certain point because something happens that I found very disturbing. So take that for what you will. Another book that you know who writes good books, that Anne Leckie. She does. I mean, she's a little unknown author that I have discovered.
Little known, not very many awards. Yeah.
No. She needs me to really help her profile here. She has a new book coming out called Translation State, which is in her Imperial Radish. Is that not Radish? Radish.
I don't know how to say it. Radish. Yeah, sure.
I don't know how to say it. But anyway.
Radish. I think that's great.
I do
the Imperial
too.
Radish.
Yum.
I like radishes. They're spicy. Just like this book. And this book is, it is seemingly a slight tale of a woman who, through circumstances, gets an opportunity to do a super easy job seeing the galaxy, but decides that she's actually going to do the job, and that causes a lot of trouble. And a lot of things happen.
I'm in already. This sounds great.
Yeah, it does.
You get into, you don't necessarily, Jason and I were kind of talking about this in the Incomparable member Slack. You don't have to read the previous books, but you certainly will have a greater appreciation for this book if you do, but I think it does stand alone. And I think the reason why it delves into a particular thing, this the translators that show up in other very mysterious things that show up in the other books, we get, they're still, even after reading this, they're still very mysterious,
yes.
But you get more, it's one of those things where you find out more and you still have more questions about, like, well, how does any of this work? So, really good. I imagine it will be nominated for the Nebula and Hugo for next year. When it's eligible, but it's fantastic.
Yeah,
I agree. I just pre-ordered it, so thanks, Scott.
I agree, Scott. I just finished it this weekend. It is very good. Yeah, it does help in the sense that you'll be more primed for what this universe is, but otherwise, mm-hmm. if you just jumped into it, you'd be like, oh, wow, there are a lot of aliens and there's weird stuff going on. And that's kind of all you really need to know, but I think it's a lot richer if you spent those three books being like, what's the deal with the Presker translators? Because this mm-hmm. book is sort of like, well, here's sort of their deal, but then you get to the end and you're like, yeah, but what about that? How did that happen? And what does that mean? And it's like, there's still more questions there. Yeah, it's both this almost like a cozy mystery kind of thing of like, well, your grandmother died and you and somebody bought the whole estate out from under her in some sort of a reverse mortgage, but it's okay because you'll be taken care of. And go off. Why don't you go off and investigate this cold case, right? Like with
wink,
Richard
wink.
Osman.
You don't just take a while
and take your time. And of course, instead, she steps in, or C steps in. It's one of the things about this is it is in truly Anne Leckie's favorite. There. Not only is she going to make you think about lots of different pronoun choices, but you have characters of indeterminate genders because it's Anne Leckie and it's the Imperial Roach series, and it's going to be like that. And so that's kind of fun too. Anyway, so you've got that part, and then you've got this coming of age where you've got these two fairly young characters, and you're like, how are they connected to the story? And boy, are they connected to the story! But it takes a little bit for you to get to that point, and for it all to fit into place. And very well done. It is so much about what struck me about it, Scott, is that it's about sort of like who you are and whether it's determined by your, you know, how you were raised or what culture you're in, or whether it's determined by your, you know, your own personal choices. And I think that Anne Leckie is saying it's complicated, but I think that she asks a lot of interesting, challenging questions about, there's a character who is raised in a horrific environment, and has some terrible practices. And then there's a character who was not raised
so
in that environment,
Jason.
and actually did okay. And then they're told, well, like, no, you're a menace to society. And their response is, no, I'm not. And there's this question of like, well, have they been lying to themselves about this? Or they ultimately are these people who said, well, they're just like this, they're monsters. Are those the people who are responsible for them being monsters? It's interesting stuff going on there that I thought I really liked. So, yeah, it's Anne Leckie. She's pretty good, Scott. She's pretty good. Translation State.
Check it out.
And I am going to, I was going to recommend Translation State, and I know I wouldn't get there because Scott would do it. But I got to jump on there. The one I will throw in is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabriel Zevin, which is not science fiction really, but it's a story about two people who are video game developers. And they meet as kids because they're in a hospital. One of them is there because their sister has cancer, and the other one is there because he's been in a horrible accident and has like lots of broken bones. And they sort of like become friends and bond over video games. And then they go to college in Boston together and meet again. And they it goes back and forth between sort of like you seeing this relationship being built, and then also these asides that keep happening that are like, well, of course, then the next year was the famous thing that they both did together that made them super famous. And you're like, oh, okay. Or are we telling a history? Is it a history story here? Or is it present day? And the book wants to have it all the ways. So, but I found it really just very good. These characters and how they bounce off of each other and how they're both very flawed. And they have, and they make lots of mistakes. And I actually really appreciate that the story is all about how human these characters are and how many terrible mistakes they make. but that they also have these connections to each other. My frustrations with it are there is an arbitrary plot point that happens at one point that it felt like maybe the author just needed some things to get shaken up, that it felt very much like there's actually a moment in translation state like that too, Scott, right? There's a moment where you think it's going to become a courtroom drama and then things start to explode and you're like, okay, yes, maybe not. And I thought, did Anne Leckie get to the point where they were getting to the courtroom drama and she's like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just blow things up now.
Need a spaceship.
Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow has a moment like that that I thought was not necessarily earned. And I also think it ends at a strange point where it's sort of like, oh, these people are going to, you know, they're famous and are they going to work together again? And then the book's like, well, that's the end. Okay. So I guess we don't know the answer to that question. But still, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, good book about, especially if you're interested in like a book about people who are, you know, they're making their next, you know, the next great video game and they have the challenges and like, do they follow their hearts and make something that is what they want? Or do they make something that's more of a commercial appeal? And then they're also their fraught personal lives. And yeah, it's good. That brings us to the end of the book club, but I get to announce our new selections for next time, because we do that in advance now because we're better podcasters than we used to be. And so
is that why?
Yeah, we're nicer. We're more professional. We actually know what we're reading next and say so. I think that's just, it's a service we provide. And also we got our act together to know what it is.
I forgot what we're going to read. So I'm excited.
Well, I'm decreeing it too. That's also part of it. So maybe it'll be a surprise. There are three Nebula nominees left on our agenda. Now that we've done these two, I am choosing two of them. We are going to read Nettle and Bone by T. Kingfisher next.
Yay.
And we're going to read Legends and Lattes by Travis Baldry.
Woo.
Oh, the ampersand series.
Next, yes. There are, it's only two books, not four books. We're not reading Nettle, Bone, Legends, and Lattes. We're reading Nettle and Bone and Legends and Lattes. Two totally different books. Next time, as the awards reading marches on. It's not a slog. It's a march.
It's a march. No. A death march.
No, it's a book march.
Wait, what?
Oh.
It depends.
Oh, no. I've given everything away. That's it, though, for this episode. Let me thank my panel one last time. Thanks for reading the books. Erica Ensign, thank you.
I can't wait to read something else.
All right. Well, you will, probably. I think Legends and Lattes is going to go over big with this crowd. I just read that, too, and I think it's going to go over big with this crowd. Although maybe Scott won't like it because it's nice and friendly and fuzzy and warm. And Scott doesn't like it. Scott's a meanie. Scott McNulty, thank you.
No thanks to you, Jason. I am lovable. People like me.
That's true.
It's true.
I don't like them, but they like me.
Yeah, I was going to say. Fair enough. Well, you may. We'll see. We'll see if whether it passes the Scott test or not. Aline Sims, thank you.
I would like to thank the listeners who told me on Instagram that they like me on the book club because they never agree with my opinions.
All right. Well, they know who they are and they're nodding along in this episode. And Deb Stanish, thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome. I love oceans.
Oceans.
Oceans. Some people oceans like for the
him.
Win.
Some people are against him. Go figure.
Check him out.
Canadians.
Yeah. Anyway, that wraps up this one. We'll be back in a month or two with those next two books, two ampersands, two books. And thanks for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.